Once more, the Harrison Watch, like an Hungarian vampire, despite the best efforts of good Lunarians upon the Board of Longitude to impale it, has risen upon brazen wings in soft rhythmic percussion to obsess his position, his dwindling circle of time remaining upon Earth, his very reason. It reached its peak in 67. The B of L, in its wisdom, kept insisting on one trial after another. Finally, they hung it around my neck. New in the job, what was I supposed to do? Say no? To oversee trials of the watch at Greenwich, for God's sake, for nearly a damned year. Maskelyne had been observed glaring at the locked case, to which he held the key, apostrophizing the miserable watch within that could render moot all his years trooping in the service of lunars, with more of the substance of his life than he could healthily afford, staked upon what might prove to be the wrong side. Were honor naught but honor's honor kept, some thought they heard, all sins might wash away in tears unwept. Couldn't believe it, reported the room steward, Mr. Gonzago. Like watching Hamlet or something, isn't it? Went on like that for weeks. He wanted to break in. He didn't want to break in. He spent hours with scraps of paper, elaborating ways to damage the watch that would never be detected. He lived in this tension, visible to all, between his conscience and his career. Bringing it to Greenwich upon an unsprung cart over the London lanes might have done the job alone, Mason suggests to Maskelyne, none too gently. Retired navigators and ship's carpenters crept up the hill to witness this, feeling like macaronis who've paid their threepence at Bedlam. Yesterday, so vouches my mate, old Maskey, he screamed and raved for quite an hour. Let's hope he's not too tired to give us some kind of show. I'd settle for a London minute. Look at my side of it, Maskelyne would blurt at them, too passionately, as he saw right away. That is, untying his cue and commencing to scratch his head furiously and at length, they've put me in an impossible position, haven't they? I mean, it isn't a secret of state that I've an interest in lunars, nor that this blasted Harrison watch is the sole obstacle between your servant and the prize he has earned fairly at the cost of his vision, his sleep, his engagement with society. Ordinarily, I'm the last one that ought to be given any authority over it, let alone the key permitting access. Yet, if you ask why, you will hear, we are ensuring his honesty this way. He dasn't fiddle with it now. And if the watch comes through, despite Maskelyne's curatorship, why then it has seen the fire and conquered it. How am I supposed to feel? The burden upon me is more than anyone should justly be made to bear. Like being the swab who holds the anchor pool. I, the purser of time. He looks a bit furtive to me. What say ye, boats? Like setting a spaniel to guard the prize cock. Gentlemen, Maskelyne, according to some, screamed. Why this unfriendly attendance? Is it the per diem? Is that it? You wish, what, sixpence more? A shilling? Shamed, disappointed in him, the veterans of Cartagena and Menorca began to move, sighing and muttering away. I am of mathematical mind. 'Twould be an afternoon's work, recreation, rather, to devise a way to destroy the watch's chances forever. And yet there is bound to be some inquiry, wherein each of my moments, since I was laden with this impossible duty, must be accounted for. Yet already too many have passed in solitude, unwitnessed by others, such as your good selves, a blank sheet that invites fiction and her vulgar friends, slander and vilification, to sport upon it. Dodgy. Then why not be hung for a sheep as a lamb? Maskelyne continued. I often find myself asking, not of God exactly, but of whatever might be able to answer the question. If the world already believe me party to a fiddle, when I'm not, you understand, then why not go in there with a hammer, so to speak, and really do a job? Classical, grumbles Euphrenia. Easy to find fault with the Reverend Dr. Maskelyne, her brother agrees, though with our 11th commandment, I must not speak ill of another clergyman. His behavior toward Mason was ever consistent with that of a brotherly rival for the love of and the succession from their father Bradley. Did he, in posting Mason out of England, employ a code to Cavan in order to put him once again among Ulstermen as he'd been upon the peninsula frontier? To Chehalion out of some mean desire to remind him of the error Cavendish pointed out due to the Allegheny Mountains? Or Cavendish, being, after all, more enemy than friend, were these rather simple kindnesses in standing by an old colleague and ally? The long-winded letters to Mason in the field, though surely meant to assert his personal authority, may reveal nothing beyond their desire, out of resentments unvoiced, to bore their recipients into compliance. At Cambridge, he had been now and then upon the receiving end of a jobation or lengthy reproof, and perhaps this was his way of reasserting in his life a balance, having been born beneath the scales that would otherwise have been set alop by an excess of patience. It also appears that he did what he could to support Mason's claim to prize money from the Board of Longitude for his refinements to Meyer's lunar tables whilst seeking none for himself. And he backed the younger Harrison's admission to the Royal Society, despite the ease with which his opposition might have been understood and excused. Nor was his approach to the Longitude ever the most congenial to have taken. The method of lunars being by no means universally loved, its tediousness indeed often resented, and not only by midshipmen trying to learn it, many wished for a faster way, willing to cede to machinery a form of human effort they could have done without. Maskelyne faced that when he became Astronomer Royal. There might be an investiture, a passage, a mystery, an outfit. He began designing, with the utmost restraint and taste, of course, ceremonial robes for himself based upon the doctor's robes at Cambridge. Rose upon scarlet, a black velvet hat, liripipes, tippets, sleeves to the ground, decorated all over with zodiacal glyphs and a subdued gold passementerie. But to whom could he show it? The Royal Society might not approve, the king might be offended. When, at all, might he have occasion to wear it? Perhaps an occasion could be proclaimed, Star Day. Everyone up all night, no flame allowed, food misidentified in the starlight, lovers a tip, and some glamorous stars like the Pleiades upon the rise. And the king would place in his hand something preserved from the days of the astrologers, a prism, an astrolabe, a gift of power. He would be sworn to secrecy. Of course, he would use it wisely. Mason has almost presumed to think of them as old troopers by now, with the transits of Venus behind them, Harrison's watch, battles budgetary and vocal, lost and won. Weary veterans of campaigns in which has loomed as well the amiable beanpole Dixon, secretly afraid of what they were all caught up in doing, as if at the behest of the stars, which somehow had begun to take on for him attributes of conscious beings. "Seen it before," quoth Maskelyne. Rapture, without a doubt, for some reason dissenters are particularly susceptible. Attacked by vertigo if he continued too long at the eyepiece, lost in terror before the third dimension, indeed running, when there was a choice, to earth rather than to fire. Desperate to pretend all was well, face kept as clear as the bottom of a stream in August, nothing visible at the fringes of readability, who knew him truly? What might wait at the margins of the pool, mottled, still, river silt slowly gathering upon its dorsal side? At the end of the day, all Mason knows of Maskelyne is how to needle him. Maskelyne, I cannot go. Yet, as if uncertain as to how much Maskelyne intends to make him plead, that is, he cannot help adding, if it pleases your grace. The Astronomer Royal is not prepared. Again you renounce me, he does not exactly intend to blurt, his scowl appearing slowly like a blush. Bloody infuriating, Mason. I know. Why not have another bowl of café au lait? And look ye here, a lovely iced bun. Here, suppose you go to Scotland only as a sort of scout. Look at likely possibilities, report back to us. Us? Pay Mr. Dixon a visit upon your way, for heaven's sake. I've your permission for that, have I? Mason. Half a guinea a day. Gentlemen usually accept a single honorarium, plus daily expenses. This might be quite in your line, Mason. Try not to say line, Maskelyne. That is, mask, then, flirtatiously, plain old mask. Chapter 75. At the request of Maskelyne, I am coming north, a mountain of suitable gravity to seek, whose presumed influence might deflect a plumb line clearly enough to be measured without ambiguity. Though given the AR's difficult history with plumb lines, I feel apprehension for the project. Having determined, after deep study in Mr. C. Dicey's County Atlas, that it is impossible to travel from here to Scotland without passing your doorstep, I should be obliged for any recommendation of a good inn for the night, whence I shall beg leave to make thee a brief visit. I pray that thou suffer no further from the gout. I am well enough, in body. Our afflictions are many, proceeding from an unilluminated region, deep and distant, which we are used to call by names more reverent. It will be 4 years, Brother Lenz. I hope it is not too long, nor yet too soon. To which, the Queen's head is Bishop's best, yet my own house being around but a couple of corners, I would have to insist that thou improve the emptiness of one of its chambers. Besides, at the Queen's Head, despite the excellence of its larder and kitchen, strict insistence is kept upon appearing on time at the table, which might prove inconvenient to thee. We'll find the carp shy of human company, the dace fat and slow, but none so much as thy servant, Jay. Mason finds Dixon still gloomy about the death of his mother back in January. Though they had finally found the time to be together, sometimes was too much, and they fell to bickering. Thou should have gone when thou had the chance. Jerry, thou never were one for pit work, nor it for thee, and father, thou know, never was expecting it of thee. Bonny time to be telling me, thou. You were the baby. The baby can do no wrong, don't you know, thou? So Dad came to an agreement, Jeremiah pressed, with Mr. Bird? Dear Nas, Jeremiah. How could he repay Mr. Bird? Dixon asks of Mason years later. That's what I can't see. Of course it matters to him. Mason has his own mysteries in this regard. What could the miller of Ware have done for the director-to-be of the Honorable EIC? Bread? Coal? He speculates. A few pence off upon the chaldron, 'twould add up, yet in that quantity. Suggests a need for high heat, sustained over time. Glass? Iron? Mason is content for the moment simply to sit inside the jolly pitman and a carousing of Geordies, feeling settled, quietly plumb, seeing against the neutral gray of the smoke all the sun flashes from the day, the clear slacks, the sand bottoms, the nettles, and rose bay willow herb, the sudden streak of light as the most gigantic carp he'd ever run across in his life keeled what in legend will be recalled as but inches from his foot. It was the notoriously long-lived Canny Bob, said to have been chased by the Romans who once encamped up above Benchester. But as you froze there, seemingly the object of torpidinous assault, Dixon tells him, after Bob has made his escape, I hesitated to approach you, for fear of electrocuting myself. At least I was able for once to observe him at some leisure. He strangely seemed to like you, Mason. I've never had that good a chance at him. No one I know has been as close as you. The Romans round here used to say, carpe carpum. That is, seize the carp. All right, I waited too long, but think how embarrassed all your friends would have felt had a stranger taken him, and my first time on the river, too. Just as well, really. There is a fragility about Dixon now, a softer way of reflecting light, such that Mason must accordingly grow gentle with him. No child has yet summoned from him such care. Thou must attend closely to the dace up here as well, for they look exactly like Chubb, yet they are night and day when it comes to the fight they'll put up. Excuse me, one looks at the fins. 'Tis fairly obvious which is which. Not here, I fear. Nor will River Weir Chubb have much to do with the bread baits you no doubt learned to use down in Gloucester. What then? Some rare beetle, I imagine? Some rare beef would better do the trick. They are blood-crazed and feral. Despite their best efforts, talk will ever drift to their separate transits. Maskline kept me over there, says Mason. Nothing but weather, day after day. Couldn't get enough obs for him. Would have taken the projected age of the universe. Brought me back upon a meat ship. In the hold were hundreds of lamb carcasses, once a sure occasion for resentment prolonged, now accepted as part of a day inflicted by fate, ever darkening. Exile to which he must, in ways unnamed, perhaps this late unable to include simply, persist. In the heavy weather of late November, the carcasses thumped against the bulkheads, keeping exhausted and increasingly irritated Mason from sleep. Deep in the mid-watch, his mental bung at last violently ejected by the gases of rage, he ran screaming to undog the hatch into the forward cargo space, and was immediately caught, a careless innocent at some ball of the dead, among a sliding, thick meat battery, the pale corpses only a bit larger than he, cold as the cold of the sea that lay, he hopefully reminded himself, just the other side of these timbers curving into candleless blackness. Oof! As the ship rolled, some dead weight, odorous of sheep fat, went speeding by, headed for the port side, nearly knocking Mason up on his arse, and obliging him immediately to spin away upon one foot, whilst the ship pitched heavily down and up. Fine business. His intention, a true phlegmatic's, having been but to locate the offending carcass, being unable to allow in his data more than one, and secure it, somehow, imagining the meat hold well supplied with any lines and hardware he might need. Fool, here were the representatives of every sheep he had ever spoken ill of, and now he was at their mercy. But they are dead, he told himself. Aye, but not only dead, here was a category beyond dead, in its pointless humiliation, its superfluous defeat. Stripped, the naked faces bruised and cut by the repeated battering of the others in this, their final flock, they slithered lethally round him. He had a clear moment in which he saw them moving of their own will, nothing to do with the movements of the ship, elaborately, the way dancers at assemblies danced. Well, I certainly wouldn't want to be a disruption here, Mason roared at them, waiting, blind as a corn in a mill, to be crushed. The situation held little hope for him. Wherever he stepped, he slipped, there being no purchase upon the deck, owing to the untallied tons of fat that had long made frictionless every surface. Mason, instantly recognizing the same proximity to pure equations of motion as he had felt observing stars and planets in empty space, with only the beautiful silence missing now. However'd thou get out of that one? Dixon wonders. Ah, the smell alone might have done for me. Quite snapped me back. Yes, it did, like a spring, back to that damned cape. I recall being very annoyed that my last earthly memories should be of that dismal place. Purgatory has to be better, I told myself. Maybe even hell. Fortunately, just then, a party of sailors, who for some reason were neither on watch nor asleep, seeming indeed almost furtive in demeanor, rescued me. I noted, too, a puzzling air of jollification, some of it directed at me. How is it in there? One of them asked with what, upon shore, would certainly have been taken as an insinuating leer. Not how was it, which is odd enough, no, what this sailor distinctly said. Why, aye, Mason, thou see it, don't thou? They were sailors. 'Tis probably a standard practice upon those meat voyages. Something a foremast swab in his day's unrelenting bleakness might have to look forward to when the midnight hour creeps round. What do you mean? Oh, Dixon, really? Dixon shrugs. If a lad were wide awake, kept his wits about him, why, the pitch of danger, at thy speed, that lack of friction, and one's mates in there as well, might be just the thing. And then at the dock, Mason continues brusquely, at Preston, for the captain declared that he would not risk Liverpool, this enormous crowd were waiting, some of them quite fashionable-looking indeed, significant wigs and so forth, running about, screaming, setting fire to factor sheds, and now and then to one another. Was the food riots, the same having pitched, as I'd thought, to full fury when I sailed for Ireland, now a year later, far from having abated, reached even to proud Preston. And what of the rest of England? My father, had they burned down the mill yet? No one was there to meet me. The sunlight above decks was smeared, the shadows deeper than daytimes. The mob, many of them small and frail from hunger, yet possessed by a titanic resentment that provided them the strength, stormed the ship and began removing lamb carcasses, the abasement of these not yet complete, and throwing them into the water, casting away food they might rather have taken with them and had to eat. The loud insanity, the pure murderous thumping. Thou wouldn't have wished to go out there at that moment either. The captain allowed me to shelter in his quarters till it should be safe to emerge, proving meantime an engaging conversationalist, particularly upon the topic of mutton, as to which he seemed most well informed, and even strangely affectionate. Of course, being, as I'd say, the sultan of the arrangement. Well, it never occurred to me, too late to do anything about it. Pity, thou might have had a bit of fun in there at least. Arr, with its corollary, that whatever I do imagine as fun invariably produces misery. Not only for thee, adds Dixon, pretending to scrutinize the fire, but for every unfortunate within thy ambit as well. Gave thee a rough time, didn't I, friend? Reaching to rest his hand for a moment upon Dixon's shoulder before removing it again. Oh, Dixon, nodding away at an angle from any direct view of his partner's face, as rough times go, the French were worse. Then 5 years of mosquitoes, of course. The old astronomers sit for a while in what might be an embrace, but that they forbear to touch. Quite a lark you must have had. I returned from the North Cape in some confusion, wishing but to put distance between my back and Hammerfrost, a salving I went, in a true panic, all the way to London, hoping the while that I had only slammed my knob once too often upon the roof beams of that dwarf's hovel the Navy styled an observatory. Would have welcomed the chance to see thee, to talk, but Maskelyne was being a nuisance as ever, and thou were yet in Ulster. Bailey went to the North Cape. I was put off about 70 miles down the coast at Hammerfrost on Hammerfrost Island. The ground was frozen so hard it took a week to dig a hole for a post to fix the clock to. Then it snowed for a week, sometimes with violent winds and hail. The days just before the transit were hazy, and now and then very hazy indeed. On the morning of the transit, the first sight I had of the planet, she was already half emerged. 10 minutes later, for one instant, through a thin cloud, it seemed she was upon the sun. Yet no thread of light. 6 hours on, the same thing. Caught her going off the disk, internal contact was already past. One swift view, and then the clouds came in again. Got the eclipse later, next day took the dip to the horizon. Here was the world's other end. One stood upon a great bluff and looked out upon the Arctic Ocean, the horizon strangely nearer than it ought to have been. 'Twas amid this terminal geometry that I was visited, Mason appearing to hear no resonance, taken then, yet further north. Ah, can Dixon see the apprehension in his face? How far was that? Hours, days, he appeared with no warning. Very large eyes, what you would call quite large indeed. I had no idea who or how many might have been dwelling in this desolate place. You must come with me, quoth he. I have a ship leaving in a few hours, man, I mumbled, and kept on with my paperwork. HMS Emerald, Captain Douglas, there will be no wind until we return. Come. I looked up. He was undeniably there. I had not been upon the island long enough for rapture of the north to have set in. For a moment I thought 'twas Stig, a shadow of Stig. You recollect our mystical axeman, with his nostalgia for the north, so in command of him. Yet my visitor's eyes were too strange, even for Stig. His aspect, his speech, were nothing I recognized. We descended to the shore and went out upon a great floe of ice, and so one floe to another, until all had frozen into a continuous plain. In his movement, he seemed as much a visitor as I in this country. From his pack, he unfolded a small sledge of caribou hide, stretched upon an ingeniously hinged framework of whalebone, and from a curious black case produced a device of elaborately coiled wires set upon gimbals, which he affixed to the prow of the vehicle. Hurry! I had barely climbed aboard when the whole concern spun about, still pointing, as a needleman I surmised, to the north magnetic pole, and began to move faster and ever faster, with a rising whine, over the ice prairie. Sir, I would have shouted, had the swiftness of our travel allowed me breath, sir, not so far, when I'd really meant to say, not so fast. We sped thus northward in perpetual sunlight. Night would not come to that latitude. The sun up there from mid-May to late July does not set. The phantoms, the horrors when they came, would not be those of night. Nor, as things turned out, would it be a journey to the North Pole. The pole itself, to be nice, hung beyond us in empty space, for, as I was soon to observe, at the top of the world, somewhere between 80 and 90 degrees north, the Earth's surface, all round the parallel, began to curve sharply inward, leaving a great circumpolar emptiness. As Mason shifts uncomfortably and looks about for something to smoke or eat, directly toward which our path was taking us, at first gently, then with some insistence, downhill, ever downward, and thus, gradually, around the great curve of its rim. And 'twas so that we entered by its great northern portal upon the inner surface of the earth. A patiently challenging smile. Mason sits rhythmically inserting into his face an assortment of Meg Bland's cookies, tarts, and muffins, pretending to be silent by choice, lest any phrase emerge too farinaceously inflected. Dixon continues cheerfully. The ice giving way to tundra, we proceeded, ever downhill, into a not quite total darkness. The pressure of the air slowly increasing, each sound soon taking on a whispering aftertone, as from a sort of immense composite echo, until we were well inside, hundreds of miles below the outer surface, having clung to what we now walked upon quite handily all the way, excepting that we arrived upside down as bats in a belfry. The interior had remained less studied philosophically than endured anxiously by those who might choose to travel diametrically across it, means of flight having been developed early in the history of the inner surface. Their god, like that of the Iroquois, lives at their horizon. Here 'tis their north or south horizon, each a more and less dim ellipse of skylight. The curve of the rim is illuminated, depending on the position of the sun, in greater or lesser relievo. Chains of mountains, thin strokes of towers, the eternally spilling lives of thousands dwelling in the long estuarial towns, wrapping from outside to inside as the water rushes away in uncommonly long waterfalls, downward for hours, unbraked till at last debouching into an interior lake of great size, upside down but perfectly secured to its lake bed by gravity as well as centrifugal force, and in which upside down swimmers glide at perfect ease, hanging over an abyss thousands of miles deep. From wherever one is, to raise one's eyes is to see the land and water rise ahead of one and behind as well, higher and higher till lost in the thickening of the atmosphere. In the larger sense, then, to journey anywhere in this terra concava is ever to ascend. With its corollary, outside here upon the convexity, to go anywhere is ever to descend. With great cordiality and respect upon all sides, Dixon was taken to the local Academy of Sciences and introduced to the fellows. "Nothing to do with your actual appearance," Dixon said, "but all of thee have such a familiar look. Up above we hear many tales of gnomes, elves, smaller folk who live underground and possess what are to us magical powers, who've mined their ways to the borders of our world, following streams, spying upon us from the fells when the light of the day's tricky enough. Is this where they come from, then?" "They are we," one of the inner surface philosophers, removing his hat and sweeping into a bow, the others, in echelon, following identically, hat brims all ending up in a single, perfectly imbricated line. "Your servant, sirs. You receive messages from us by way of your magnetic compasses. What you call the secular change of declination is whatever dimmed and muffled remnant may reach you above of all the lives of us below, being less lived than waged at a level of passion that would seem to you quite intense. We have learned to use the telluric forces, including that of magnetism, which you oddly seem to consider the only one." "There are others," Mason perking up. "That's what he said. Almost effective and what we'd style miraculous down there, though perhaps not as much so up here. Thy trip to Scotland will be closely watched, Mason, from below. Once the solar parallax is known, they told me, once the necessary degrees are measured, and the size and weight and shape of the earth are calculated inescapably at last, all this will vanish. We will have to seek another space." No one explained what that meant, however. "Perhaps some of us will try living upon thy own surface. I am not sure that everyone can adjust from a concave space to a convex one. Here have we been sheltered. Nearly everywhere we look is no sky, but only more earth. How many of us, I wonder, could live the other way, the way you people do, so exposed to the outer darkness? Those terrible lights, great and small. And wherever you may stand, given the convexity, each of you is slightly pointed away from everybody else, all the time, out into that void that most of you seldom notice. Here in the earth concave, everyone is pointed at everyone else. Everybody's axes converge, forced at least thus to acknowledge one another, an entirely different set of rules for how to behave. We happen to be looking through a telescope of peculiar design for hundreds of yards around whose eyepiece, specula of silver, precisely beaten and polished to a perfection I was assured had cost the sanity of more than one artisan, were spread like sails for catching every least flutter of luminosity, conveying to a central set of lenses the images they gathered in. With this instrument, one could view any part of the hollow earth, even places directly across the inner void, thousands of miles distant. Though light through the polar openings north and south varied as the earth traveled in its orbit, 'twas never more than low and diffuse, hence the enlarged eyes of these inner surface dwellers, their pale skins, their diet of roots and fungi, and what greener esculents they might go to harvest out in the more arable country round the openings. though the journeys back inside were fraught with peril and inconvenience from armed bands of vegetable pirates. Leaves in here were nearly black in color, fruit rare. The wines, Dixon shaking his head, are as austere as anyone can imagine. You've not become a great person, Dixon. The damned gout. Wine's not as bad. Mason bleakly exhales. No hell, then. Not inside the earth, anyway. Nor any single administrator of evil. They did introduce me to some functionary. No telling. We chatted. Others came in. They asked if I'd take off as much of my clothing as I'd feel comfortable with. I stepped out of my shoes, left my hat on. They walked round me in circles, now and then poking at me. Nothing too intrusive. Nothing you remember, anyway, Mason can't help putting in. They peered into my eyes and ears. They looked in my mouth. They put me upon a balance and weighed me. They conferred. Are you quite sure now, the personage asked me at last, that you wish to bet everything upon the body, this body, moreover, to rely helplessly upon the daily harvest your sensorium brings in? Keeping in mind that both will decline, the one in health as the other in variety, growing less and less trustworthy, till at last they are no more. Eh, well, what would you have said? So did you. We left it in abeyance. Arrived back at the observatory, it seemed but minutes, this time in transit, I sought my Bible, which I let fall open and read in Job chapter 26, verses 5 through 7. Dead things are formed from under the waters and the inhabitants thereof. Hell is naked before him, and destruction hath no covering. He stretcheth out to the north over the empty place, and hangeth the earth upon nothing. Upon the doorstep, horses waiting him in the street, Mason grasps Dixon's hand. If they don't kill and eat me up there, shall we do this again? We must count upon becoming old geezers together, Dixon proposes. They are looking directly at one another for the first time since either can remember. Let us meet next summer. You must come stay in Sapperton. I may not travel far. Immediately reaching out his hand to Mason's arm, lest Mason in his way take too much offense, I wish it were not so. Mason, as he long has learned to for Dixon, refrains from flinching. No loss, perhaps. Thanks to the damned clothiers, no one can guarantee what, if anything, swims in the Frome anymore, avoiding any prolonged talk of frailty, which he can see is costing Dixon more than his reserve of cheer may afford. The mills, curse them all. Dixon, I shall be happy to see you wherever you wish. He turns to the strap securing the transit instruments, ignoring what is just behind his eyes and nose. Mind thyself, friend. Chapter 76. Now, Dr. Johnson, along with Boswell, acting as his squire, happened, in August of 73, to be crossing into Scotland as well, upon their famous trip to the Hebrides. More likely, snorts Ives, they didn't pass within 100 miles of Mason. Yet, speculates the Reverend, did all hesitate upon the border at some rude inn just before taking the fatal step across into the Celtic unknown. Sitting at a table, drinking ale, observing the mist through the window panes, Mason, 45, the Cham, 64. You seem a serious young man, with Thameside intonations in your voice, if I'm not mistaken. Sir, I saw you at the Mitre Tavern once. Royal Society, are you? As your own intonation already implies, sir, not bloody likely, is it? Though I have contracted with them, and more than once. You're the Stargazer, what's his name? Mason, Boswell informs him. Damme, if that's not it exactly, says Mason. Thank ye, gents, although this time I am come upon an errand of gravity. He explains to them his search for a Scottish mountain, suiting as many as possible of masculine stipulations. Boswell's gaze brightening. He's Clive of India's brother-in-law. Do you suppose the Nabob wants to buy a mountain? Good Lord! Masculine working in confidence as a land agent? I never thought of that. Then you are not as corrupted as you believe you are, at least according to the creases of your phiz, sir, somewhat brusquely announces Dr. Johnson. Such relative innocence may be a sacred asset, yet a secular liability. May you ever distinguish the one from the other. Oh, and Mason, your servant. Be careful. Of what, sir? Of the attention you'll be getting up there, if your principal's illustrious relation becomes widely known, warns Mr. Boswell, himself a Scot. Upon the map I carry, declares Dr. J., nothing appears beyond here but mountains. In practice, to examine them all is a task without end. And every Scot you meet will be trying to sell you at least one that he, and ignore not she, happens to know of. These people are strong, shrewd. Be not deceived by any level of the exotic they may present you. Kilts, bagpipes sort of thing. Haggis, you must keep unfailing vigilance. Mr. Boswell bows elaborately, whilst keeping his eyeballs upon the roll. Out there in the fog, brimming and sweeping now over ridgetops and into the glens, somewhere it waits, the world across the next line, in darkness and isolation, barren, unforgiving, a nation that within Mason's lifetime has risen to seize the crown, been harrowed into submission, then been shipped in great lots to America. I imagine there's yet a bit of resentment about. The doctor snorts. The word you grope for is hatred, sir. Inveterate, inflexible hatred. The 45 lives on here, a ghost from a Gothic novel, ubiquitous, frightfully shattered, exhibiting gallons of a certain crimson fluid. Typical of the people, don't you see? Aye, he means me, sighs Mr. Boswell. He picks up the bone remnant of a chop and gestures with it. Soon he will commence with the cannibalism jokes. Pray you, miss it not. 'Tis more hilarious than may at first seem likely. All his lifelong enmity, emerging at last in this way. No one knows why, but he intends to go to the Hebrides, to the furthest isle, to view the Dark Ages upon display. The uncomplicated people, laboring with their primitive tools, gushes Mason. The simplicity of faith. Lo, it's time reborn. It's fascinating, this belief among you men of science, remarks Dr. J., that time is ever more simply transcended, the further one is willing to journey away from London to observe it. Why, Mason here has done the very thing, cries Boswell. In America. Ask him. Mason glowers, shaking his head. I've ascended, descended, even condescended, and the list's not ended, but haven't yet transcended a blessed thing, thank ye. The savages of America, intones the doctor, what powers do they possess, and how do they use them? As if here, at the edge of the world, they might confide what no one would ever say aloud in London, with Boswell a bustle to get it all scribbled down into his quarto. The abruptness of the doctor's question reminds Mason of himself, addressing the learned English dog a dozen years ago. His mouth creeps upward at the corners, almost achieving an horizontal. Would that my coadjutor, Mr. Dixon, were here, says Mason, missing Dixon as he speaks, for the magical, in all its occurrences, to others of us how absent, was ever his subject. Oceans, rain-making, the undoing of enemies remote, that Mandeville of Mohawks would be sure to enlighten you. I can myself testify to little beyond the giant mounds that the savages say they guard as curators for some more distant race of builders. I have failed to observe more in them than their most impressive size, though Mr. Dixon swears to coded inscriptions, purposive lamination, and employment under the present day by agents unknown of powers invisible. Yet, appropriately enough, what compels me out under the elements once again now is yet another damned species of giant mound, and after hoping I'd seen my last in America. Woe, it seems, I've acquired a specialty, and the elevated, the chosen, go on assigning me to these exercises in large-scale geometry. This mountain I'm about to seek must be regular as a prism, as if purposely constructed in days of old by forces more powerful than ours. Powerful enough to suggest that God, whatever that may be, has not altogether quit our own desperate day. You're not pleased with his frequency of appearance, frowns Johnson. Sir, be wary, for the next step in such petulance is to define him as some all-pervading fairy dust and style it deism. Do you think I wasn't looking all that long, arse-breaking American time? Mounds, caverns, things that went across the sky. Had you seen one of those, 'twould have made you think twice. Even giant vegetables, if it had to be, seeking salvation in the oversized. How pitiable. What of it? I've little pride, some great squash upon the trailside. I'll take it, won't I? I'd have been happy with the Cock Lane ghost, Johnson mutters. Happy, Mason nods, his eyes far too bright. You were ill-treated, sir, in that matter. Be careful to note, Boswell, how even a lunatic may yet be civil. Thank you, sir, or is it your holiness? I? all but pleading for someone's judgment of madness, as if desiring to be admitted to that select company, select as the Royal Society, which did not want him either. I had my Boswell once, Mason tells Boswell. Dixon and I, we had a joint Boswell. Preacher named Cherry Coke. Scribbling everything down, just like you, sir. Have you, twirling his hand in ellipses, you know, ever had one yourself, if I'm not prying? Had one what? A Boswell, sir. I mean, of your own. Well, you couldn't very well call him that, being one yourself. Say, a sort of shadow ever in the room who has haunted you, preserving your every spoken remark. Which else would have been lost forever to the great wind of oblivion? Think, arm sweep south, as all civilized Britain gathers at this hour, how much shapely expression from the titled gambler, the barmaid suitor, the offended fopling, the gratified tosspot is simply fading away upon the air, out under the door, into the evening and the silence beyond. All those voices. Why not pluck a few words from the multitudes rushing toward the void of forgetfulness? The mountain he finds for Maskline will be too regular to be natural. Like Silbury Hill, it will have the look of ancient earthwork about it. And it will be Maskline who goes to Schiehallion after Mason refuses the assignment again and becomes famous for it, not to mention beloved of the Scots people there, the subject of a ballad, and presently a figure of legend in a strange wizard's turnout based upon an actual observing suit he will wear whilst in Perthshire. A plaid one, in fact, of Maskline's own design. A tartan never observed in the world, he explains, that no one clan up there be offended. Or everyone, Munn is quick to point out. Mason will go back to Waking day after day in Saberton, piecing together odd cash jobs for the Royal Society, reductions for Maskline's almanac, small children everywhere, a neat observatory out in the garden, a reputation in the Golden Valley as a sorcerer's apprentice, who once climbed that strange eminence at Greenwich, up into another level of power, sailed to all parts of the globe, but came back down among them again. They will all be easy with him, call him Charlie at last. Another small-town eccentric absorbed back into the weavery, keeping a workspace fitted out someplace in the back of some long Cotswold house, down a chain of rooms back from the lane and out into the crooked looming of those hillside fields. Chapter 77. So when they meet again, 'tis in Bishop, and any third observer might note in an instant the deterioration the year intervening has brought to each. Dixon's pronounced limp and bile-stained eyeballs, Mason's slow retreat, his steps taken backward, only just stubborn enough to keep facing the light into melancholy. Increasingly ill at ease with change of any kind, be it growing a year older or watching America, once home to him as the desert to a nomad upon it, in its great convulsion, Mason has begun to dream of a nighttime city. Of creeping among monuments of stone perhaps twice his height, of seeking refuge from some absolute pitiless upheaval in relations among men. 'Twas Stonehenge, absent Becca, and the moonlight. The monuments made no sense at all. They were not statues, they bore no inscriptions. They were the night's standing stones, put there by some agency, remote, not in time, but from caring at all what happened to the poor fugitives who now scurried among them, seeking their brute impenetrability for cover. Whoever their makers had been, they were invisible now, with their own chronicles, their own intentions, whatever these were, and they glided on, without any need for living witnesses. Were this but a single dream, wiped out as usual by the rattling quotidian, Mason might even have forgotten it by now. But it keeps coming back. More accurately, he returned to it, the same city, the same unlit anarchy, again and again, each time to be plunged in the middle of whatever has been going on in his absence. At first he visits fortnightly, but within the year he is journeying there every night. Even more alarmingly, he is not always asleep. Out of doors against his will, a city in chaos, the lights too few, the differences between friend and enemy not always clear, and mistakes a penny a bushel. Reflection upon any topic is an unforgivable lapse, out here where at any moment death may come whistling in from the dark. Well, hello, death, what's that you're whistling? Ooh, little Ditters von Dittersdorf, nothing you'd recognize, hasn't happened yet, not even sure you'll live till it's performed anywhere. Have to check the folio as to that. Get back to you. No hurry, truly, no hurry. You cute rascal, Death reaching out to pinch his cheek. Sometimes Mason wakes before traversing into the next episode. Sometimes the bony thumb and finger continue their approach asymptotically, ever closer, be he waking or dreaming something else. Their visits, wrote the Reverend on unnamed authority, consisted of silence when fishing, fevered nocturnal conversation when not. Though even beside the weir or in it, are they ever conversing? In their silences, the true measure of their history. Mason arrives one day to find Dixon sitting there with giant heaps of cherries and charcoal. Have some, offering Mason his choice. Excuse me, the gout is eased by things that begin with C-H? Why, aye, they don't know that down in Gloucestershire. Chicken? In the form of soup particularly. Chops? Cheese? Chocolate? 'Tis considered an entertaining affliction by those who have not suffered it. Oh, Dixon, I didn't mean... Every turn now, a chance for someone taking the hump. Here, your cushion, may I... First thing is, you mustn't touch the foot, thank thee. Bit abrupt, sorry, yet do I know this by now like a county map, where the valleys of least pain lie, and where the peaks to avoid. Every movement has to be planned like a damned expedition. Meg Bland is the only mortal, nothing personal, who may even breathe too close to it. Lucky me, says she, in the door straight as a swift, a tall, ginger-haired beauty disinclined to pass her time unproductively. Margaret Bland gave up on marrying Dixon long ago. Indeed, these days is reluctant, when the topic arises, even to respond. We'll have the wedding just before we go to America, he said, and we'll go to America as man and wife. For a while, she was a good sport and allowed herself to be entertained with his accounts of what adventure and wealth were there to seize in that fabled place. But there soon grew upon her, as she had observed it in her mother, a practical disillusionment before the certainty of death that men, for their part, kept trying to put off as long as possible. She saw Jerry doing just that, with his world of maps, his tenderness and care as he bent over them, as herself resigned to tending him. No different than man and wife, really. I love her, he tells Mason. I say the, yet to myself I think, she's my last, my, how would I say? She's a good woman, Mason says. Thou must see that. Bringing me cherries every day, for this, pollicating the toe. Shaking his head, laughing in perplexity, he looks over at Mason, finds Mason looking at him. The girls are mine. Mason, who rarely these days smiles, smiles. Well, 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 in fact. They sit nodding at each other for a while. Thou must have seen it in their faces, in Mary and Elizabeth, for fair. So that's what it is. Well, they are beautiful young women, despite it all. Thy boys, they must be nearly grown. Mason nodding. Oh, and I got married again. Forgot to mention that. Then we had Charles Jr., then 2 weeks after he was born, my dad got married again. We both married women named Mary. Thou would like them both, I know, mine in particular. She's young? Amazing, how do these people? Strange Geordie powers, friend, and I know thou need as many children as possible as a bridge over a chasm to keep thee from falling into the sky. Charlie, the baby's the very image of my dad. That's what's so peculiar. The boys look like Rebecca, but the baby, the resemblance makes me jumpy. I expect him to start shouting at me. Sometimes he does. Can't understand any of it, of course, but then I can't make out my dad either. Hey, then all's fairly as usual. I come to the mill every morning, and he gives me one loaf. Take thee this day thy daily bread, every time. His wit, his great fun for him. How inveterate a hatred shall I be able to enjoy for someone who looks like my baby son? Thou seem disappointed. Next worst thing to unrequited love, isn't it? Insufficient hate? And yet it's done thee a world of good. The months, often years of time thou didn't know thou had. Years off my age. And we've another coming in right about harvest time. Yet how can thou be sure? Maybe I hate children. Then feel free to ignore my wish of much joy, Mason. Shouldn't thou be in Sapperton with thy Mary? Her mother is there, and they are just as content to have me away. They are dozing together by Dixon's hearth. Both their pipes are out. The fret has gathered in the waste places, crossed them, and come to the edge of the town. Anything may lie just the other side, having a peep. There is jollity at the Queen's Head, though here in Bondgate, for the moment, the bricks are silent. Each is dreaming about the other. Mason dreams them in London at some enormous gathering. It is named the Royal Society, but is really something else. Some grand testimonial, already many days in progress, up on a stage, before a pit in which the crowds are ever circulating. Bradley is there, living and hale. Mason keeps trying to find him so that Dixon and he may meet, but each new face is a new distraction, and presently he cannot find Dixon either. Dixon is dreaming of a public performance as well, except it's he and Mason who are up on the stage, and whoever may be watching are kept invisible by the lights that separate stage and pit. They are both wearing cheap but serviceable suits, and backed by a chamber orchestra, they are singing and doing a few simple time steps. It was fun while it lasted, and it lasted quite a while, for the bleary-eyed lad from the coal pits, and the gazer with big city style. We came, we peeped, we shouted with surprise, though half the time we couldn't tell the falsehoods from the lies. I say, is that a... No, it ain't. I do apologize. This astronomer's life, say, pure as a fife, hey, quick as a knife in the dark. Oh, we went out to Cape Town, Philadelphia, too. Though we didn't quite get to Ohio, there were marvels aplenty to view. Those trees, those hills, those vegetables so high, the cataracts and caverns and the specters in the sky. I say, was that? I hope not. Who the deuce said that? Not I. It's a wonderful place, ho. Nothing but space, go off on a chase in the dark. Dixon wakes briefly. It had damned well better be bodily resurrections, all I can say. One final expedition, Dixon believed, a bit more gold in the sack, and he'd be free to return to America, look up Washington and Franklin, Captain Shelby and the other lads, find the perfect seat in the West. He knows where the coal is, the iron and lead, and if there's gold, he'll witch that out of the earth, too. The trick lies less in hollowing out the wand or putting in the tiny samples of everything you're not looking for than in holding it then so as to adjust for the extra weight. Let George have all Cockfield Fell. In America is abundance, impossible to reach the end of in one lifetime. Hence, from the mortal point of view, infinite. By the time he might have emigrated at last, Mary Hunter Dixon had grown ill, and in January 73 she passed to a better place. Busy with rebellion, America drew back toward the edges of Dixon's frame, where the shadows gathered. In the meantime, the demand for coal in Britain promising to ascend forever, there seemed to Dixon no reason to abandon too quickly a sure source of work in order to cross the ocean and settle in a wilderness of uncertainty. American reports that reached him mentioned Shelby's fighting in the West and all the Macleans joining the Virginia militia. By then Dixon had surveyed the park and demesnes of the Lord Bishop's castle at Bishop Auckland, and the year after that all of Lanchester Common. Wilderness enough for him, though no longer is he sent quite as much into panicked incompetence by the Alladade, by moorland unenclosed, as if he has found late protection, or at least toleration, from the fell beasts of his younger days. At the plane table, he erases his sketching mistakes with bits of bread he then keeps in a pocket, not wishing to cast them where birds might eat the lead and come to harm. Now and then, only half in play, he will take a folding rule and measure the ever-decreasing distance between the tip of his nose and the paper, for among surveyors, 'tis said, that by the degree of proximity there betwixt, may you tell how long a draftsman has been on the job, and that when his nose at last touches the paper, 'tis time to retire. He continued to postpone the American return, whose mere projection had separated him from Mason, and to recognize more clearly, as the days went along, that his life had caught up with him, and that his death might not be far behind, and that America now would never be more real than his remembrance, which he must take possession of in whatever broken incompleteness or lose forever. I was sure my fate lay in America, nor would I've ever predicted that, like thee, I would swallow the anchor and be claimed again by the life I had left, which I had not, after all, escaped. Nor can I accurately say 'twas all Meg's doing and the girl's, for I was never like thee, never one for duty and so forth, being much more of a flirtatious bastard, thus thee, yet I couldn't leave them again. That was it, really. To leave home, to dare the global waters strange and deep, consort with the highest men of science, and at the end return to exactly the same place, used, broken. Nobody's dream of a life for fair. You always wanted to be a soldier, Dixon, but didn't you see that all our way west and back, I and the transits too, were campaigning, geometric as a Prussian cavalry advance, though in the service of a flag whose colors we never saw, and that your behavior in a hostile territory was never less than, I, likely to be mentioned in dispatches? I'll take it, gratefully. The only hope, I suppose, is if we haven't come home exactly. I mean, if it's not the same, not really, if we might count upon that failure to re-arrive perfectly, to be seen in all the rest of creation. I hope that's not the only hope. They have been nymphing by moonlight in the weir, hoping for sea trout, though finding none. Now upon the bankside, Mason and Dixon sit, smoking long white clay pipes, whose stems arch like fishing poles, and bickering about the species eluding them. Dixon seeming to Mason far too eager to lecture, as if having assumed that Mason has never seen a sea trout, which, though true in a narrow sense, doesn't rule out his having felt them once or twice at the bait. Whilst not as shrewd as the carp, Dixon declares, yet are they over-endowed with pride, and will have thee know there are things a sea trout simply will not do, such as waste his time upon an insect that dares the flow too briskly, there being too much humiliation for him should he attempt capture and fail. Humiliation before whom, Dixon? Frogs? Grebes? You have discussed this with the sea trout here personally, have you? Perhaps even more than once? I ken them, sir. I see into their minds. 'Tis how I know that thou must leave aside thy own pride and learn to feign with thy bait weakness, uncertainty, fatigue. They hear swift footsteps close by, and in a moment behold, approaching them, sniffing industriously, a Norfolk terrier of memorable appearance. Well, God's periwig, whispers Mason, 'tis he. Can't be. What's it been, 15, 16 years, and this one scarcely a year old? Yet, see how he holds his head? Old Fang's way to the arc second. Yes, it's all right, lad, come on. The dog, as if not wishing to intrude, waits, tail a thump. Why, he's the very representation. Might he have been with those strollers lately at the Queen's Head that vanished in the middle of the night? Happen they left him behind? We'll not insist that ye speak for your supper, offers Mason. Not at all. Come back with us, and we'll see about that, shall we? The dog accompanies them to Dixon's house, dines unselectively, though not gluttonously, and having made amiable acquaintance with the dogs already resident there, stops overnight. Quite at home to appearance, Mason remarks next morning. Nay, clearly 'tis thee he fancies. He's a town dog. He'd much rather stop with you than journey all the way to Sapperton. Nay, why cannot thou see he can't wait to be back upon the road, touring again? A modest wager, perhaps? We never settled for thy great race in Chestertown 10 years ago, twixt Selim and Yorick. Really? Which horse won? Who did I bet upon? The dog listens to them for as long as he may, before standing, stretching, and trotting away to explore Bishop, nor reappearing till that night, round supper time. There you are again, Meg Bland, stooping to greet him. I've been making him those fried American cornmeal articles of yours, Jerry, to have with his fish. What'll his name be? Fang, says Mason. Learned, says Dixon. The dog ignores both, however, as if his true name is one they must guess. Each day the weather allows, he accompanies Mason and Dixon to the river and watches whilst they fish. He does not venture to speak, indeed only barking once, when Lud Ofery, an otherwise unremarkable person of middling age, comes down out of the willows and into the water, pretending to be a pike in fierce descent upon the dace shoals, attempting to send all the fish he may into a panicked stampedo. "Sacrilege, where I come from," mutters Mason. "'Tis but Lud's bit of diversion, whenever he's above ground. Throw him a chub, and he'll be off." As Mason's departure nears, Dixon can see he's growing more and more anxious upon the topic of canine speech. How then? Coerce him? Shame him? Think not. Yet one would expect, wouldn't one, the dog as ever bright-eyed and companionably attending, that out of professional obligation at least. Hey, Mason, really? All right, ever so sorry. Close to dawn, dreaming of America, whose name is something else, and maps of which do not exist, Mason feels a cold nose at his ear. "When ye wake," whispers a youthful South English voice, "I'll have long been out upon the Darlington Road. I am a British dog, and belong to no one, if not to the two of you. The next time you are together, so shall I be with you." They wake early. The dog has gone. Dixon reports the same nose, the same message. Did we both dream the same thing? I was awake, as certainly was I. Then must we see him again next year? Chapter 78, the last chapter. Now 'tis very late. Dawn is the next event to consider. Candles have been allowed to burn all the way out. No one has uncorked a bottle in some time. Tenebrae slumbers beneath the canopy of the Chinese sofa, whilst her cousins, sprawled in chairs, are